Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. Welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. That's me. I am in, 1 Corinthians chapter 2 right now. It says in verse 9, however, it is written, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to us by his Spirit. Isn't that awesome? The Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. For who among men knows the thoughts of a man except the man's spirit within him? In the same way, no one knows the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. What a great thought to contemplate. It is Friday already, and I can't believe I always get a chance to talk to Alex McFarland every other Friday, and that Friday has arrived, so I'm already in a very good mood, or I should say an above-average good mood. I love every day of the week. I love Mondays. I love Fridays. I love every day in between because it gives us a chance to open up God's Word, look at it, and find out what and how we can grow in our faith. Now, Alex has recently just had a very busy day yesterday, the National Day of Prayer, and he was got this really nice title, if I could find it real quick. He served as the National Student Movement Director for this year's National Day of Prayer. So I want to find out all about that, find out exactly what he did. I want to hour by hour, play by play of what went on in Alex's life yesterday. So let me take a break, and in 60 seconds, we'll find out.
Have you ever wished you could listen to your favorite radio program when you wanted to? That way, you'd never miss a program you really wanted to hear, simply because your program came on when you had an appointment, you were at work, or something urgent came up. And for those really busy days, you could listen early in the morning or late at night when things were calmer, and you could take the time to reflect and meditate on what you heard. Well, you can listen to your favorite programs whenever you want. Download the Faith Radio app by searching Faith Radio in the Apple Store or Google Play Store to gain instant access to Faith Radio programs and previous shows. It really is that simple. Search and subscribe to your favorite program and listen anytime. Download the Faith Radio app today and don't miss a thing. Once again, go to iTunes or Google Play on your mobile device and search for Faith Radio to download the free Faith Radio app and start listening today.
I play that music for Alex. I know he likes it. Dr. Alex McFarland is a religion and culture expert, a national talk show host and speaker, authored 20 books, creator of the Truth for a New Generation Apologetics Conference, partnering with Liberty University, and a host of Exploring the Word on American Family Radio. I don't know what he does in his spare time because this pretty much takes up all of his time, but he was also recently named the National Student Movement Director for the National Day of Prayer. I want to find out all about that. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm also a really, really big Bill Arnold fan, and so thanks for having me back on.
Of course.
And how you been, man?
I've been well. I've already got it marked on my calendar, June 21, Alex McFarland in Minneapolis. We're going to have lunch. You're going to come on the radio show. It's going to be great.
That's right. And you know what? I haven't booked my travel yet, so let's talk because I want to book my travel and block out enough time to meet your great staff up there at the radio station.
I practically insist.
Indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
Yeah.
Well, yesterday was the National Day of Prayer, and I trust in Minnesota there were a lot of people gathering to pray.
There were.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned the student movement. You know, as an evangelist traveling and writing and kind of always on the go, I've got the privilege, and it really is a great privilege, to interact with a lot of people. And probably 7 or 8 months ago, we talked to the people at the National Day of Prayer, and we were talking about getting young people engaged. And so we set up a website, and we didn't have any budget or anything. It was really word of mouth, really viral. But, you know, we tried to get, we wanted every state represented, and I don't know that there were teen groups in every state. I mean, there might have been, but officially in about 25, 26 states, we were able to help over 200 prayer groups get organized of young people, you know, praying for the country and, you know, gathering. And we interfaced with a lot of organizations, a lot of churches, a lot of youth pastors. But, you know, we wanted to put the ethic of prayer in the hearts of a lot of young people. And you know what, Bill, is so cool? They take it seriously. I mean, that these teens and young people, I mean, their walk with Christ and praying for their friends, praying for safety, praying for their schools, and praying for the country, they rose to the occasion, I will say.
That is such encouraging news. I love hearing that. Now, obviously, with the National Day of Prayer yesterday, I think prayer and having a National Day of Prayer is needed now more than ever in our country. Tell me why you would agree with that statement.
Oh, well, great question. I would agree with that question because of the rise of secularism, the rise of Islam, the rise of relativism, that there is no ultimate truth. You know, everybody does whatever they want. The rise of hedonism. Hedonism means just living only for pleasure. But think about this. In my home state of North Carolina, okay, North Carolina is a place of thousands of churches, the birthplace of Billy Graham, you know, a great evangelist. Historically, you know, North Carolina has been steeped in Christianity. But I was doing some work prepping for all. I did a lot of media interviews yesterday. 25-26% of people in North Carolina, 35 and younger, would say they don't believe in God. Or maybe they're, you know, agnostic. Maybe there is a God, but who knows? And so, you know, 74-75% are Christian, but, you know, and there's a small, maybe 2% that would be of other religions. But, you know, Bill, we've never seen an America where 1 out of 4 doesn't believe in God. And our belief in God informs our belief about so many other things, morality, you know, just the value of things like religious freedom and moral truth. And so the rise of secularism is part of why we so urgently do need the National Day of Prayer and to intercede for our nation.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of a little word game here, a little wordplay, but is murder against the law because it's wrong?
Great question. Is murder against the law because it's wrong? Well, I think it's important to make a distinction between murder and killing. Sadly, police officers and soldiers have to kill.
Right.
But not all killing is murder. Murder is wrong. It's against the law. In cultures that have a moral code, it's against the law because it is taking something that doesn't belong to you. You know, murder is really a form of stealing.
Mm-hmm.
Taking somebody's life, you know, because another person's life doesn't belong to us. Even our own life, strictly speaking, doesn't belong to us. Self-murder is wrong, too. But I would say ultimately the wrongness of murder is because it's an offense against the Creator.
Right.
And let me say this. Sorry to be so verbose here, but we're made in the image of God. And Imago Dei, we're image bearers. Murder is an affront to our Creator because it really, when a person is murdered, it's really a blasphemy against the Maker whose image we bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree completely. I'm trying to, you know, I've left some breadcrumbs for me to return to this concept, because when you talk about the secularization of the world that we're heading more and more towards, if murder is, if it's against the law because it's wrong, or is it wrong because it's against the law?
Oh,
I know that
right,
sounds
okay.
Confusing. If it's wrong because it's against the law, let's just change the law. Then it's not wrong anymore.
Yeah, and that is not our judiciary or our moral code. Great, great point. And I would please ask people to listen very carefully. There's a philosophy called voluntarism. as in voluntary. And the question is, you know, is something right because we've made a law about it, or did we make a law about it because it's right?
Mm-hmm.
And really, in the Christian worldview and in the Western world, and this goes all the way back to the 1100s British common law, in the Western world, which is frequently called Christendom, we made laws because it squared up with the law of God.
Right.
And Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he would repeat this a lot, and he would quote very artfully and very accurately. Dr. King quoted Augustine to support this point, and he was absolutely right on it. He said, laws are valid when they are in harmony with the law of God, which is written on the heart of all people. So here's one of the differences between Christianity and Islam. If we ask the question, is something right because we do it, or do we do it because it's right? In Christendom, we'd say we ought to do this or that because it's right, because it harmonizes with the law and the nature of God. But in Islam, they would say, no, Allah is not bound by his own nature, and we're not, you know, bound by anything other than the will of Allah, and something is right because we do it. But you see, that's the relativistic outlook of even the Third Reich at Nuremberg, when the Nazi war criminals were tried. Their defense, Eichmann and Rudolf Hess, their defense was, it was right for us because we passed laws. But the Court of World Opinion said, there is a higher law that supersedes all of our man-made laws, and that's the law of God, and it's written on every heart. That's why, folks, my opposition to abortion is that it's unscriptural, and it's murder, and it's a lot of things, but abortion is a violation of natural law. And when Alexander Hamilton talked about social justice. You know, it's so interesting, Bill. You know, we hear so much about social justice. The phrase was originated by Alexander Hamilton in his defense of the Constitution, and he said we could only have a socially just society if we followed the law of God. So the progressive SJWs today that really want, you know, unrestricted abortion, mm-hmm. gay marriage, transgenderism, they're taking the phrase and turning it 180 degrees on its head. My point is, we can only have the America that the founders envisioned, and the America that has given us all this prosperity, freedom, and opportunity, if we retain acknowledgement of natural law.
Yeah.
And we've got educators, elected officials, media pundits, Hollywood, hammering away day after day after day, calling us to abandon belief in moral absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to lead to lawlessness, and we're already seeing the beginnings of this.
Yeah. Alex, you are so smart. If you ever write 20 books, let me know, okay?
Listen, man, I'm just a saved sinner who's excited about Jesus.
Me too. After a short break, I'll be back with Dr. Alex McFarland. Thanks for being with me today. I am very glad to be joined by Dr. Alex McFarland, a religion and culture expert, national talk show host and speaker, author of many, many books, and just a great friend and resource to Faith Radio. We're always so glad to have you on the program. Alex, when you were engaging with students on the National Day of Prayer, obviously we put a lot of hope in young people. What were you hoping that these young people would be motivated to do after this day of prayer?
Oh, great question. Well, number one, be more committed than ever to let Jesus Christ lead their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we grown-ups do need to pray for this young generation, and we need to role model Christian fidelity. You know, when I was in high school, I mean, there were things like alcohol and marijuana. I mean, there were the stoners and, you know, there was, I think, in our high school of over 1,000 students, there was one out of wedlock, pregnancy, and that was, the community scandal.
Mm-hmm.
But comparatively, I think our simple life was probably pretty manageable compared to what kids have today. I mean, my goodness, if ever, young people need a moral compass. It's now, because the internet, as great as it is, my goodness, there's everything from, terrorist groups to human trafficking to pedophiles to, how to use your chemistry set to synthesize, illegal drugs. And then there's the breakdown of the family. And do you know what? I was in a group and somebody was saying that in many parts of America, something like 73% of children born to minorities would be born out of wedlock. 73%. And, one of the greatest predictors of whether a child will graduate high school, thrive emotionally, intellectually, and then launch as an adult is the home life from which they come. Now, here's the thing. Let me paraphrase C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis said, if you're trying to reconcile your checkbook and you've got a math error and you can't make your checkbook reconcile, it really doesn't help just to keep on doing math. You have to go back and figure out where you made a mistake in your arithmetic. With America, we're just doggedly pressing forward, telling ourselves that we can live as if there is no God and there are no moral boundaries. And we're going to have to, and Bill, I don't know how much blood will have to be spilled and tears be shed before we admit this, but we're going to have to go back and say, the family was important, and no-fault divorce, and you can walk away for any reason, that's been devastating. We're going to have to go back and say abortion on demand is wrong, and life is sacred, and choice begins before you get into bed. You make the choice to stay virtuous and pure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to have to, regarding homosexuality and gay marriage, we're going to have to admit that the norm for, 6,000 years of human history has been heterosexual monogamy. And we can tell ourselves that egalitarianism is true. Egalitarianism is from a Latin word for equal. And, everybody might not really realize this, but what we're in a period of militant, enforced egalitarianism. Everything's equal. Homosexuality is commensurate with heterosexuality. Well, it's not. Well, maleness, femaleness, transgenderism, or androgyny, they're all equal. No, they're not. Just like hungry is not the same as being full. Dead is not the same thing as being alive. So we've got to address the arithmetic error, shall we say, of egalitarianism. And I would say education is important, but godless education is dangerous. And we've got educators now that are militantly insisting that we can live without God, we can live without a high view of life, we can live without recognition of morals, we can live without Christianity, and we can live oblivious to the fact that some things are different. I'm not saying better or worse, but male is different than female. I'm not saying one is superior, one is inferior, but they're different.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what's killing America is that we're drinking the Kool-Aid of egalitarianism. And it's just one of the many toxins from which we must turn if we intend to survive as a people.
Mm-hmm. Alex, let me drift back a little bit to the National Day of Prayer, just prayer in general. And I was thinking about the whole idea of praying for your enemies, that whole concept. What are your thoughts on that?
Wow. Now you're making me feel convicted.
No. I'm just saying it's we're supposed to do that, and
we are supposed to do that, aren't we?
Oh yeah.
And do you know what? It's hard to be sideways with somebody when you're praying for them. and in life, hey, you know, it's a fallen world and we're fallen people. Inevitably, you know, there are going to be people that we don't like. But you know what? I want to say this. Oftentimes we hear about Islamophobia or homophobia. Okay, Bill, in the circles that I travel, I've been in some very, very, very conservative churches. I've stayed in the homes of some very, very, very conservative leaders. I mean, like, you know, 10 miles beyond conservative. And yet, honest engine, I never, ever, during the 8 years of Obama, I never, ever heard a Christian or a pastor say a disparaging word about Obama. Now, they didn't like a lot of his policies, but I've been in churches and homes and groups where people poured out their heart praying for Obama, praying for the Clintons, praying for Norman Lear in Hollywood, praying for the Muslim world to find Christ. And so I want to say a big thumbs up to the American evangelicals. I know, you know, the media calls us deplorables and, you know, Bible-toting, you know, gun-toting, you know, ignorant simpletons, phobic about this, that, and the other. That's not what I've experienced in 2,200 churches. In fact, 2 years ago, I quit counting how many churches. But I've been in 2,200 churches, the lower 48 states, at least a dozen times each, more than 200 universities, 27 maximum security prisons. I mean, I've seen America. I've never, ever heard a Christian say that they hated somebody else.
Wow.
Now, disagree with policy. I wish Ruth Bader Ginsburg would support the Constitution, not denigrate it like she did in May of 2012. When she said that, you know, if Egypt is going to write a new constitution, don't look at ours. That's what she said. I wish she would support the constitution that she's paid to defend and uphold, but it doesn't mean I hate her. I love her. I wish the best for her, and I pray for her. But don't you think it's a little unfair how conservative Christians are often painted as phobic and haters merely because we disagree with policies that they want us to roll over and play dead to accept?
Yeah, it's a smear campaign. They're just going to want to keep smearing us as much as they can, as often as they can.
Yeah, but so the good news is, as Chesterton said, G.K. Chesterton once said, "There's a silhouette that's run across the stage of history, the white horse of truth." And he said, "You know, at the end of the age, when the mists of Armageddon clear, there's this silhouette, you know, shaky, reeling, scarred, wounded, but standing unvanquished. Truth will prevail in the end." And we know it will.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Alex, for coming on to the show. Always great to talk to you. Have a wonderful weekend.
God bless Faith Radio and the Bill Arnold Show.
Thank you so much. Dr. Alex McFarland has been my guest. His website is alexmcfarland.com. AlexMcFarland.com. We'll take a short break and be joined in a few minutes by Dr. Paul Kengor. Dr. Paul Kengor is an author and professor of political science at Grove City College. He's an executive director of the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City, and he's written many books, and all of them are absolutely fascinating. His most recent one is The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, which is a great book. If you've not heard about it, you're going to hear about it again today. And he's also written Takedown, From Communists to Progressives, How the Left Has Sabotaged Family and Marriage. And a favorite of mine, A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill, good to be back with you. Thanks.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your work and your availability. Awfully nice of you. I know you've had a busy day. You just got done teaching class, and you raced into your office to talk to me.
That's exactly right. What a better way to end the week.
Well, thank you so much for that sentiment. I share it entirely with you. So, you know, as I'm looking at what's going on in Venezuela, and I literally cannot believe these stories and these pictures, and I thought I need someone to help make sense of this, so I call Paul Kengor.
Well, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by it, right? And you and I probably aren't. You know, a lot of people, I'm afraid, probably are. But yeah, this is what Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez, who was the predecessor to Nicolas Maduro, who's the current leader in Venezuela. This is what Hugo Chavez promised would be 21st century socialism. That's what he called it. In fact, if you Google the words 21st century socialism, a little Wikipedia box pops up, and you'll see there that it was Hugo's term. And the many American progressives, self-described American progressives, socialists, democratic socialists, and even Marxists, they were all jazzed up about this thing called 21st century socialism. Venezuela was going to shine the bright path ahead. They were going to lead the way, and you know, this time socialism was going to be done just right, just beautifully, just wait and see, just watch and see.
Right.
And, yeah, and you look at it, and it looks, Bill, a lot like 20th century communism.
Yeah.
Because that's 21st century socialism, and people waiting in line for toilet paper, and incredibly, even waiting in line for gasoline in a country where toilet paper might not grow out of the ground in Venezuela, but oil actually does. And they can't even get oil in mm-hmm. that country. And you know, this is what socialism and central planning does time and time again. They never learn.
So, Paul, when I look at some of the American candidates that are trying to get everyone's attention, how come candidates like, you know, maybe Bernie Sanders is not calling out Maduro and not saying, you know, he's a socialistic dictator?
Well, it's quite the contrary. Bernie Sanders was pointing us to Venezuela a few years ago, and what they will do now that it's failed is they'll say, which is what they always say, oh well, they didn't do it right in Venezuela, right? We're democratic socialists here, you know, we're 21st century, no, we're 2019 socialists, right? And If you give us power, you know, just enough, you got to give us enough power. And if you don't give us enough power now, then it won't be our fault. It'll be your fault, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you just give us enough power and we'll do it right this time, right? You know, I know that they said they would do it right before, and some people said that Chavez would do it right this time. But you see, well, it just still hasn't been tried right yet. And so after 700-800 times, you know, batting 1,000, just give us this group of really smart people, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Bernie Sanders, the Justice Democrats, the Democratic Socialists of America, give them enough power and they'll make it work this time. Just trust them.
Mm-hmm. Does that sound reasonable to the average discerning American? Just give us more power?
Well, you know, I would hope no, that they would reject it. But I don't know. I mean, Bernie Sanders got 13 million votes in the Democratic primary in 2016. He said, you know, that was Hillary Clinton got 17 million votes. And so Bernie got 13 out of 30 million votes in the Democratic primary. That was 40% of all Democratic Party votes. So, and you know, Donald Trump got 14 million votes in the Republican primary. And so Bernie was just a little bit behind that. And, you know, Trump had a record number of votes for mm-hmm. a Republican primary. So I don't know. You would think that people would know better, but you have quite literally millions of millennials right now saying that they prefer socialism over capitalism and calling themselves democratic socialists. So I don't know. I don't know if you can trust the American public with this anymore. I mean, it's hard to say.
Yeah. Paul, is it safe to say that the history of socialism gone wrong is just evidence for fallen human nature?
Well, yeah, I think it is, and you know, you have this kind of what Friedrich Hayek, the great free market economist, called the fatal conceit, the idea that human beings could really be omniscient about something like markets and prices, and being able to predict prices, supply and demand, production levels. And Hayek said, you can't have in a group of central planners, a group of people, all the knowledge that goes into basic pricing and buying decisions that are done in a free market economy. And so that's just a simple economics matter right there. But in a sort of deeper sense of human nature, anthropology, spirituality, and yes, the Christian faith, Christians understand that this is a fallen world and that utopia is not possible in this lifetime. In fact, the very word utopia stems from the Greek otopos, which means no place. So really, I mean, utopia can't be achieved anywhere, at least in this world. And the perfect world, the New Jerusalem, the heaven to come is in the afterlife. And unfortunately, I think what we get with a lot of secular left, secular progressives, secular socialists, is the idea that they think that you can create the New Jerusalem here on Earth if you just give them again enough control.
Mm. One of the things that I hear all the time when you hear these candidates talking about it is they always talk about free stuff. That must be the big tease, the big socialism tease, free stuff.
It is. And I think that's what's appealing to a lot of millennials, a lot of young people as well. The idea of free tuition, free health care, and, we've already brought them up in an educational system where they think that the public schools, that they have free education, right? You don't have free education. I mean, the typical public school spends about $20,000 per student, and that's money that comes from people's tax money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Even Cuba doesn't have free health care. Britain doesn't have free health care. If your definition of free means that, well, you don't have to fill out a check when you walk in the door or swipe your credit card, well, that's a pretty narrow definition of free. I mean, right? I mean, the stuff is paid for. It's deducted from your paycheck by the government rather than your employer.
Mm-hmm.
So you pay for it. It's not like they have magic money trees that grow in Cuba, or that they have some giant healthcare fairy who flies around in Britain and taps people on the head and gives them all free healthcare. I mean, this stuff is paid for. It's just paid for in a different means by your tax dollars. Everybody in America could have free government healthcare if you just turn it all over to the government, and then the government takes $10,000 out of your earnings here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you wouldn't see it. It wouldn't be in your pay stub. But, well, by golly, now it's free. So people don't even understand what free means.
Right.
It's a basic failure of economics education. And then on top of that, that makes possible the failure, I think, of young people to understand what socialism is, what democratic socialism is. And to not understand that the path that places like Venezuela are pursuing are going to be disastrous, and socialism would be disastrous in the United States as well.
Mm-hmm. Paul, I just had a listener text this. Is this why they suggest lowering the voting age to 16, because socialism is popular with the youth?
It's a great point. And the answer probably is yes. I mean, if a particular party had voting data, polling data suggesting that would benefit them, then I'm sure they would. And look, that's definitely, to some extent, I want to say 16 is too young to vote. But then again, I know 60-year-olds who make really, really, really bad voting decisions, right?
Uh-huh.
My 11-year-old over here, John, has more common sense than my neighbor Jim down the street with the Bernie sign in his front yard.
Yeah, but he's got you for a dad. He's got you for a dad. That makes a lot of difference.
But, I don't know about that.
But Paul, it's if we're grabbing for power, we're just going to go into every area we can find some, right? If we just want the voting bloc to get to be what we want it to be, so we're going to go to the youth and maybe let inmates and people who are murderers and rapists also vote while they're incarcerated.
Yeah, and if, you know, if they'll, let's say if you're a Democratic politician and you have data that those people will vote Democrat, then that's what you do, right? You let them vote. But you know, that is just completely self-serving, and it's wrong. I mean, you just can't do that. But of course they do it all the time.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if you know you have using your Second Amendment right, and you possess a firearm, and then you're convicted of a felony, you lose that privilege.
Right. That's exactly right. And it's amazing the parental rights that those folks are willing to take away from parents, individual rights. I mean, I just read of a case in Canada that, in fact, you might have heard of this too, Bill, where a father is being charged with the crime of violence because he tried to take his daughter to a therapist because she's thinking about gender transition therapy. And so here's the state intervening to tell the father that he doesn't have that right to do that. So it's these kind of vagaries of the political left. They will empower you with the vote or individual freedom or whatever when it serves their purpose, and then on other occasions, completely remove it when it doesn't serve their purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing, Paul. Dr. Paul Kengor is my guest. We're going to take a little break. We'll come back more with him. And if you want to head over to Amazon.com, just type in Paul Kengor, K-E-N-G-O-R. You'll see all of the books that he's written. He is one bright guy. We'll be right back. Dr. Paul Kengor is my guest. He's an author and professor of political science at Grove City College, one of my very favorite people to talk to. Paul, when you wrote your book called Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century, talk, if you would, about how journalists have become tools of the communist propaganda machine.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's terrible. And that's gone on for a long, long time. And one thing that I see, Bill, with it's going on once again with the socialism stuff and where they attack the people who raise objections to the fact that some of our politicians are pursuing socialism or democratic socialism. I'll give you an example of that. Donald Trump, in his State of the Union speech, which I guess was – or not State of the Union, but State of the Union speech about – was it February, just a few weeks ago, had one or two little lines in there about how America is not a socialist country and should never become a socialist country.
Mm-hmm.
And even Nancy Pelosi applauded kind of gently, and Elizabeth Warren even stood up and applauded, which the comrades at People's World noticed and called her an erstwhile progressive because she had applauded that. But ever since that happened, I've seen probably five or six different articles from liberal journalists complaining about Trump and accusing him of a new McCarthyism and pushing out these red herrings about socialism and so forth. I'm thinking, gee, you think the guy called for a resurrection of the House Committee on Un-American Activities? all he did was mention a couple lines in a speech about how America shouldn't be a socialist country. And this happens to me all the time in my different writings. I'll be writing about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar, a couple of days ago, talked about how Angela Davis, who has long been probably the most famous female communist in America, Omar said what a great inspiration she was to her. And if you merely point these things out or point out that Mayor Pete Buttigieg, that his father headed up the International Gramsci Society, named for Antonio Gramsci, well, then you're red baiting, right? You're the bad guy. When in fact, we're just asking, you know, could we please be a little more careful and vigilant about who we elect to office? And can our politicians please not be socialists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the media criticizes us merely for voicing an objection rather than criticizing the actual socialists or the politicians.
Mm-hmm. Paul, I've got another listener chiming in saying, can you give a good answer for those that say the United States uses socialism already? Look at the police and fire and Social Security.
Yeah, and I would caution people to understand there that we are still far from socialism when we do those things. There, like for example, if you take the Index of Economic Freedom, which is done by the Heritage Foundation, I think America still ranks as the 12th most free economy in the world. And above us, I believe, is Britain, the United Kingdom, which I think they rank 11th, maybe something like that. And of course, yeah, they have National Health Service. They have socialized medicine, which we don't, or at least not yet. So you can still do some of those things without being, you know, a full blown socialist country. But there are, you know, one thing that socialists in the West have done, and I think would like to do in places like the United States as well, is if they can achieve what Ronald Reagan called creeping socialism, where you nationalize a particular industry, or you put a particular this or that under government control. If you can indeed get single payer health care, in Britain it went so far after World War II where they were nationalizing coal companies, steel companies, car companies, transportation, right? Railroads. We haven't done anything like that in America. But you need to guard against it.
Mm-hmm. Paul, maybe you could give our listeners an illustration of maybe how U.S. adversaries have exploited the American home front.
Yeah, well, that's something, too, that goes back a good 100 years. And I'd point out here, too, on Faith Radio, that they had a lot of success with the religious left, above all. And in my book, Dupes, I spent a lot of time on folks like the Reverend Harry Ward, who ran the Methodist Federation for Social Action, as it was called in the 1920s. And Harry Ward was an actual member of Communist Party USA. That's a guy who was a Methodist minister.
Wow.
Who taught at UTS, Union Theological Seminary. And Harry Ward was one of the two original founders of the ACLU, along with Roger Baldwin. And you know, Roger Baldwin certainly wasn't a minister. He was an atheist. But Harry Ward was an actual Methodist minister. And he helped create different front groups in the United States, like the American League for the American Front Against War and Fascism. That was one. He created he was one of the leaders in the American Peace Mobilization, which tried to keep America out of World War II, only because at that point Stalin was allied with Hitler. And so that was the party line position of the American Communist Party. And so they would appeal to religious left, social justice pastors in particular, you know, singing the tune of Blessed Are the Peacemakers, Jesus Wouldn't Want You to Go to War. And these things were done by American communists in order to hoodwink, manipulate American progressives and even American progressive pastors.
Mm-hmm.
So that's gone on for a long time.
Yeah.
I think you're seeing it even now with some folks in, for example, the LGBTQ community who are trying to get pastors on board for same-sex marriage. And you see it as well all the time. Any update you get from groups like Life News, you'll see different pastors that are out trying to make the case for quote-unquote abortion rights,
mm-hmm.
arguing that, you know, that if Jesus was around today, he would support a woman's right to choose. I mean, I'm not surprised to see that from Planned Parenthood, but it appalls me when I see it from a pastor in the United Church of Christ, or a pastor in a PCUSA church.
It's shocking.
Or an Episcopal bishop.
Paul, we just have a couple minutes left, and interesting at the Mueller report and these claim that the Trump administration colluded with Russia, but you can maybe tell us briefly about, you know, how shocked we were to hear that Senator Ted Kennedy secretly, you know, approached the Soviet leadership to undermine not one, but two American presidents.
Yeah, that's a perfect example, Bill. I mean, he was. I mean, Ted Kennedy, and we have an actual smoking gun document. It's a May 14th, 1983 KGB Central Committee document, which is a letter from the head of the KGB, Viktor Chebrikov, to the head of the Soviet Union, Yuri Andropov. And there he expressed an offer by Ted Kennedy to help the Soviets, to work with the Soviets in order to work against Ronald Reagan's reelection bid in 1984. And we also have the Matrokhin archives, Kennedy doing something similar to Jimmy Carter in the Democratic primary in 1980. And Ted Kennedy was gonna run against Carter in the 1980 Democratic primary. So right there, you have a very real case of, if not collusion, at least something very disturbing. And our American media completely ignored that, not only at the time, but when it was disclosed by the London Times in 1992, when I reported it in books going back 2005, 2006. And they never asked Kennedy about it the entire time that he was alive. So it's a perfect example right there of our media completely ignoring one of their guys genuinely doing something bad that quite possibly could have been collusion. And on the other hand, spending 2 years and millions of dollars looking under every possible rock that they can for some sort of suggestion of collusion by Donald Trump and the Trump White House.
Mm-hmm. Paul, when you hear polls and statistics now, do you kind of roll your eyes? Or, I mean, ever since the 2016 election, when there was a 95% certainty that Hillary was going to win, and every poll is confirming that, every time now I hear a poll, my eyes kind of roll in my head a little bit.
Well, the one thing that they can't project is voter turnout, right?
So true.
I mean, that's what it really comes down to. And Donald Trump did get, like, I think it was about 2%, maybe even 3% less vote than Hillary Clinton did, or he lost by about 3 million votes. So in that sense, the polls on the actual projection overall of how people would vote, they really weren't that off. But what they couldn't get was all the different swing states. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that Trump would get just enough votes to win Pennsylvania, that my home state, that he would trounce Hillary Clinton in Ohio, that he'd win Florida and Michigan, and that he'd sort of run the table on all those swing states. Something that we thought Mitt Romney might have done in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing that they can't quite figure it. And I know this much. If the Democrats run somebody in 2020 as unappealing as Hillary Clinton was in 2016, then they're only going to have themselves to blame for Donald Trump winning the election again.
Yeah. Paul, thank you so much for doing the show. I just love having you on as a guest, and have a great weekend.
Well, thank you, Bill, and same to all of your listeners.
Thank you so much. Dr. Paul Kengor has been my guest. And he's written many fascinating books. You head over to Amazon.com and you can check it out. K-E-N-G-O-R is how you spell Paul Kengor's name. Thanks so much to all of my guests. That wraps up our show for the week. It's time to ring the bell. Have a great weekend. Good night and God bless. I'll see you Monday. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.